Midnight in Karachi with Mavish Murad on Tour.com. Joining me today on Midnight in Karachi is writer Stephanie Salter, writer of the Evolution Trilogy, which comprises of Gem Science, Binary, and most recently, Regeneration. Stephanie, welcome to Midnight in Karachi.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm a fan of the podcast, as you know. I'm used to speaking to people who are 5 hours displaced in the other direction in Jamaica, but you're 5 hours later in Karachi, so that's a new experience.
Yes, I'm in your future. Do you want to know what happens? I can tell you what happens. Night will happen.
Yes.
All right, now let's talk about your books. Gem Signs was not just the first of the trilogy, but it was also your first book, your debut novel. Will you tell us a little bit about where the premise came from?
It's such a difficult question that because it sounds a bit new agey if I say it came in a flash of inspiration. And that's not entirely accurate, but it was a sort of a daydream moment where if you're a very imaginative person, which I am, which I think most writers have to be, I sort of had this idea a few years ago, and I didn't know what it meant. It was, and I can't say too much about what it was because it's kind of what turned out to be the climactic scene of the book. But it was one of those weird sort of almost lucid dreams that left me wanting to try to work out what it was about and what had happened. And that was just a tiny little moment. But I think the way the novel built around that was a lot of things that I'm always interested in around society and how people respond to challenges and how they deal with those they think of as the other, as not being quite themselves, in the history of social interaction and integration, or the lack of it, are all things that I'm really interested in, and I'm really interested in certain forms of science and technology, and I'm really interested in how certain patterns of behavior repeat over and over in various cultures. And I think all of those things that I tend to think about anyway sort of latched onto this weird daydreamy idea, like barnacles onto the hull of a ship, and it just sort of bubbled away there in the back of my mind for a few years. And every now and then I would write a page of notes, or I would sort of think through some aspect of it. And a few years later, it turned out that it had been a novel waiting to be written. And I don't have a better explanation than that for where the idea came from.
So it basically percolated in your mind for a few years.
Yes, but it wasn't in the form of when I finally sat down to write the book. I wrote it in about 7 months, which is a shockingly short space of time. But I think it's because the various aspects of the story had been coming together in some deep cesspool of my subconscious for about 5 or 6 years. So obviously, one of the things I've learned about being a writer is that your subconscious works really, really hard, and it doesn't matter that you don't know what's going on down there because it's happening anyway. Because I'd just been vaguely aware of certain things coming together in my head over a long period of time. And like I said, I had a file, and every now and then I'd scribble something in it. And when I found myself with some time in early 2011, and I actually started off thinking that I would try and organize all these random notes in this random file that I thought might turn into a book someday in the distant future, it was really an organizational task. And then it turned out that my method of organizing my notes was to turn them into a novel.
Did you think about all this time when you were, these bits and pieces that you were writing, was there a plot that was slowly evolving? Was there a story, or was it just, say, scenes or premises that you were sort of putting down in different time spaces?
The latter, scenes and premises and ideas about character and ideas about the setting and what had happened in the world. In a way, plot comes last for me. Which is probably not what anyone would guess reading my books, because they're very tightly plotted, and I've had people sort of assume that I must start with a master plan for plot, and that's not really how my process works. I know that certain things must happen, but more than anything else, I work out the situation that people find themselves in, and I come to an understanding of who the characters are. And I put it that way rather than saying I create the characters, because it feels more like getting to know someone than like making them up. I mean, obviously I really am inventing them, but it feels more like a deepening acquaintance. And then in a way the plot comes from working out what that person would do in these circumstances and what's logical, not just for the scenario, the constraints of the situation they find themselves in, but what that individual would or wouldn't do and how they interact with others. And that works for me. I mean, expressed like that, write it down on paper, that does not sound like a recipe for successful plotting, but that's really the way I go about it. And for whatever crazy reason, it seems to work for me.
That is strange to think that plot comes last for you, because one of the things that I noticed about your books is that I wanted to call them, you know, like evolutionary noir almost. I mean, they do read like noir thrillers.
I love that. Can I have that evolutionary?
It's all yours. Does it make any sense? It makes sense to me. But that's what and so to me, it seemed like, you know, there's a lot of thought going in on the plot, which of course there is. But now that you say that it came later, that kind of gives me a sort of, I don't know, it makes me think. It still means that what you think of as last still is very, very strong, of course.
Yes. Well, there were certain things I knew had to happen. And like I said, that climactic scene about which we can say nothing,
right,
was one of the things I knew had to happen. And the opening scene, which is actually quite removed from it in time, which is a sort of an escape, I knew had to happen. I didn't know how we were going to get from that early point to the climactic moment, but once I worked out who the characters were, then they sort of led me through it. And it has taught me. I mean, this whole process over the last few years of writing these three books and getting to know not just the individual characters but the networks and the relationships between them, because that's very important to me in my writing. Has taught me to sort of trust character. If you've created individuals and groupings that have real depth and heft and texture, then in the same way that you can understand what real people are doing in the real world, you'll be able to understand what they're doing in their imaginary world. I don't know if that makes any sense at all, but it works for me.
It's interesting that you mentioned groupings, because recently I read an interview that you'd done, in fact, on Tor.com with Liz, where you talked about community and the community of communities you had created in your books and how things moved for them. Were you thinking of, say, the Gems and then other, I mean, when we go on to talk about regeneration, we've got a whole other sort of human altogether who can breathe underwater. Are we talking about these people as their communities and how the communities would develop? Did you plan out how they would change as a whole, as well as on an individual basis?
To some extent, yes. It happened in parallel, but it sort of happened in parallel because I don't think of individuals and community as somehow being things that you work out separately, because that's not really how it works. We exist in our networks of family and friendships and workplaces and school and so on. And so we are part of how the group evolves, and the group is part of how we evolve as individuals and also as members, sort of little clusters, little nodes within the wider society. So I knew that I was not interested, as I said in that interview with Liz, in sort of doing the lone hero focus as though nobody else was around, or, you know, everybody else was sort of extraneous to the hero's journey, because I don't think that's how people are in real life. Even your real life loner is a loner from something else. They are defined by what they choose not to be part of.
Right.
And I think we've got a lot of them in literature, and I'm not sure we need any more.
Fair enough, yes.
But I really I really wanted to look at how community, as Liz put it in her question to me, how communities transition. And one of the things that I know from lived experience and from doing a bit of work around marginalized communities as well, is that people tend to stick together, especially when they are not part of the mainstream, because that is how they find strength and support. So, you know, you see the trends. Immigrant communities tend to live together. There are people who share a language and culture and food and so on. They don't tend willingly to be scattered throughout the host community. And you can think of lots of examples of that, where people with a shared identity cling to that identity, especially if they've got other external forces arrayed against them. That collective sense of identity is part of their strength. And given the nature of the story I was telling, it seemed to me quite natural and logical that that would be true for these communities as well. And even the water breathing gems, the Gilungs, who we will talk, you know, who are a big feature in Regeneration and in earlier books, are themselves just a subset of that community. They're very much a part of it as well. So, because I was, you know, this might be science fiction, it's in a futuristic setting, but I was trying to tell as realistic a story as I possibly could of what real people and real groups of people would do and how they would react in the situation that I was describing. So on the one side, you have these really marginalized groups who have huge obstacles to deal with and to try to overcome. And then on the other hand, you've got the kind of mainstream norm community who themselves are very influenced by social media and news media, which again I think is what happens out here. Even people who don't necessarily think of themselves as being particularly like each other all read the same newspapers, they all watch the same broadcasts, they're all on the same social networks, and so you've also got that groupthink that can have scale. And I was really trying to reflect a series of social movements that felt realistic in terms of what actually happens when these conflicts occur out in the real world.
Now, your gems, of course, the gems themselves are genetically modified people, genetically, what was the word? I think forced evolution, you can say, perhaps. They've been created in certain ways to have certain abilities or to have certain differences. Now, with Binary, with the second book, you move to a time when perhaps, you know, situation, society, it's a little less, it's still complicated, but perhaps a time that is a little less fraught for the gems than in Gem Signs, but of course still complicated. Now, Regeneration, the newest book in the trilogy, introduces us to a new sort of human altogether, the primary focus of it being the Gilungs, as you mentioned. How does this latest book bring about the entire trilogy together? Is this where you sort of always saw the arc going?
There are two separate questions. I'm going to break them apart there, because this isn't where I always saw the arc going, because I didn't intend a trilogy at the beginning. I didn't know that's what you were supposed to do. I just wrote Gem Signs. In the course of doing that, there was so much there that I knew it was a story that was going to be continuing, but I didn't know I was going to write it. And then when I got an agent and the agent got me a publishing deal, the publishing deal was for three books if I could turn it into the first book of a trilogy. And I tell people this who know the industry better than I did at the time, and they're amazed, because I think I must be the only author who didn't know you were supposed to plan a trilogy from the beginning. But I genuinely didn't. So that is part of why Gem Signs, Binary, and Regeneration form a continuum, but they're each discrete standalone books, and you could read them out of order if you so desired, because I hadn't planned it that way in the beginning. But having said that, having been given the opportunity to take everything that I had set running in Gem Signs and continue it. You're quite right. Gem Science is a sort of the initial crisis when things are extremely fraught and extremely violent, and there is a lot of very overt prejudice and angst and upheaval about how the world is going to work. Binary is about the process of assimilation and integration starting to become a bit more commonplace, but still being quite challenged and quite challenging for right. many members of the society. And regeneration, and I don't want to say too much about it because I realize not too many people will have read it yet, it's just come out. Regeneration is about what starts to happen when the people who were incredibly marginalized and weren't in a position to be much of a threat to the status quo not that long ago are now established, and they're now becoming so entrenched in the wider culture and its business and its politics that those societies actually starting to change. It's starting to shift because of the influence of the new people, the incomers. And so it's also about that shift of power. And so I think it would, you know, there's one of the aspects of the thematic arcs through the three books is about that notion of power, of social capital, of it being incredibly unbalanced as it is in the beginning, and the conflicts that throws up. But actually trying to look at the fact that as it becomes more balanced and less obviously violent and less obviously fraught, to some degree that just means the conflicts go in another direction, and that struggle to maintain a sort of balance of power simply morphs into something that is more subtle and more about political maneuvering, if that makes some kind of sense. And right. conscious of trying to give an idea of the big thematic arc without talking about specifics.
Now, your books are concerned with the interruptions and the changes that new technology forces onto society, onto humanity, with evolution. In this case, of course, the forced or artificial evolution, which we mentioned earlier. This is a big, big idea. These are big concepts and big ideas. So I want to know where you stand on this idea of artificial evolution, things that we're seeing now as possibilities, you know, things that start small, being able to erase, say, a certain disease from your baby's DNA, and, you know, moving on to designer babies. Pick the color of the hair, pick the color of the eyes, pick the color of the skin, whatever it is. And what was your research process like for this?
Well, as I said, a lot of this came out of things that I was already aware of and already interested in. And I, way back an age ago, I studied biology. So I actually know a fair bit about genetics, and I've always kept an eye on a layman's eye on where developments are going. So I had to do a little bit of specific research, but not very much, because I'm more concerned about the ethics of it and what I think is reasonable to imagine that society might do. And I think what's really interesting is that nobody makes a big decision to go down the path of artificial evolution. And evolution isn't something that's planned anyway. It's what happens when you're simply trying to survive. It's undirected. And part of the notion here is that what starts people down this track of altering the genome of infants in embryo is something really desperate. It's a neurological disease that is killing people, and that within a couple of generations will probably wipe the entire species out unless they halt it. So if you're faced with that kind of a challenge, you wouldn't hesitate, in the same way that we don't hesitate to eradicate a disease if we can. That's a completely moral thing to do. And I think if we were ever faced with that challenge in real life, that's probably how we'd react. But what I wanted to look at is how incrementally, how you have mission creep in a case like this, how something that is clearly the sensible, rational, moral thing to do, you make one other little decision to make one additional tweak because it's not that big a deal given the whole scope of things. And that makes it easier to make the next little change. And given that you're in an absolutely desperate situation with you know, only the very old and the very young and a virtually non-existent labor force, it makes it really easy to use your spare embryos to create the labor force initially just to grow the food so that your species doesn't die of starvation, which is the beginning of the whole phenomenon of the gems. But having done that, it's really easy to justify making the next little tweak that refines them for some other purpose. And so I wanted to sort of look at how people make these justifications for each of these decisions that on their own are not that major. But at the end of 100 years of this, you've got an enslaved subspecies of radically altered people whose role in society is to fulfill various functions that make the lives of everyone else easier. And I wanted to look at how that was plausible and how it could be made justifiable. And I wanted to do it in the sense where the parallels with things that have actually happened in human history, in the transatlantic slave trade, in the post-emancipation indentured trade in people from South Asia, actually did happen. And none of the people who did those things thought they were being bad people. They all thought they were doing what was correct and rational and necessary and moral. They all found ways of justifying it.
It's sad then, because it makes me feel like no matter what we do as society, there will always be one group of people who are the other, who are used and abused. Do you think that's an inevitability?
I think it's a tendency. I hope it's not an inevitability. I mean, part of what I was trying to do in these books is set up that situation, which has the obvious parallels with terrible abuses of the past, and try to work it out in a slightly different way to see if I could come up with a fictional narrative that led to a better result, but that was nevertheless plausible. In a way, it's a sort of three-volume thought experiment, although that doesn't... I promise readers out there that it's more interesting than that.
Right. It is. I promise you too.
But there was a level in which, because I'm from the Caribbean, I am one of the descendants of that dreadful history. And there was a part of me that thought, can I think of a better way out of a similar scenario? Can I imagine people facing the bigots that we've always had, but trying to think their way out of the problem and choosing a moral path, which in some ways, you know, in some isolated cases is what happened. Slavery was abolished in the British Empire by Parliament and not by war. And that, I suppose, is a very small triumph, but we'll take what we can get.
Right. Now, when you're writing stories about genetically modified humans, of course, there are always going to be questions about what it means to be human. It's also, of course, easy to read into these stories, as we were just talking about, that they're about race, they're about racism, they're about prejudice, about the other, about, you know, abuse of the other. What was the one sort of political or socioeconomic concern that you had in mind when you created the gems at the very start? Was there one very specific idea in your head?
I don't think there was. And it's weird because the parallels with racism are very evident now, but I wasn't necessarily thinking about that even when I started. I wanted to think about that idea of the other, of how we treat those who are considered to be different and who we think we are and who we think they are. But you can think of that along an axis like race, but you can also think of it along axis of culture, of religion, right, of immigrant groups, of sexuality and gender and so on. So it was, and one of the things I really wanted to examine, and I think this is why I wrote this as science fiction, was the whole idea of biology being somehow determinant, which is always the argument you hear, the justification for why some people are regarded as inferior, or some people's difference is medicalized, or, you know, whatever. They're really very different. And I wanted to create a scenario in which, because I'd made them genetically modified, they were really different, because then that gives you an arena in which to look at the question of what does it mean to be human? Which differences are the ones that actually affect that question of humanity? Is it actually genetic? In to some degree, it's probably, you know, it's to some degree the nature nurture question. What are the core criteria for humanity, and does it actually have anything to do with what you look like, or how fast you can run, or whether or not you can breathe underwater, or whether your hair is purple,
right?
Or you know, or something else more important. I mean, one of the early conversations I had about the book is someone said, "Well, the question really is, are you human because of your DNA or because of how you treat other people?" About whom there may also be a question of whether or not they are human.
Yeah.
And that, I think, you know, that is something that I wrote about within the books, because it's something that preoccupies me in real life. I think we find it really easy to dehumanize those who we don't know very well, but vaguely think might be a threat.
Right.
And I think that is pretty pervasive. I've yet to learn of a culture anywhere that hasn't done that at some point in its history.
Yeah.
And I'd like to see, that's the thing I'd like to see us grow out of as a species.
Yeah.
I don't think it's going to happen in my lifetime, but it's a thing that I hope for.
And I feel like it's easier for us to deal with our own prejudices once we've dehumanized, you know, the other person. We simply stop thinking of them like us. And so somehow it kind of makes it okay that we treat them badly. And by we, absolutely. I don't mean you and I mean, you know, all of humankind.
Well, absolutely. It makes it possible for us to not care. It's a way we switch off empathy and compassion, by somehow categorizing people because they look different, or they sound different, or their bodies don't work in quite the same way, or whatever. We categorize them as being not enough like us to be worthy of our empathy and compassion, and that is so pervasive, and the justifications for it are so banal but so chilling, because they recur and they recur and they recur. I am making this sound really preachy and polemical, and it, you know, I've really want to make the point that there is some quite fun stuff happening,
yes,
as well, but I can't pretend that I'm not interested in those issues.
Yeah, but the books don't read like message stories. I mean, of course there is a point to them, and we've been talking about some of the various concerns that you have with the books, but as I said earlier, there's a very large noir element, there's a very large sort of action adventure element to them as well.
Yes, well, you want to be entertained. I want to be entertained. I've been a reader since I was a very small child. I was one of those ridiculously precocious children who learned to read very young. And so I think, like all of us who are avid readers, a lot of my thinking has been informed by books, but by stories. You need a story to drag you into it. And the other stuff is subliminal. And I think actually you know, most of us don't tend to think through to what the stories are actually telling us until we're a bit older and we've got a few thousand of them under our belt. We are engaged by the story. So I know what appeals to me as a reader, and what appeals to me as a reader is not message fiction. It's not a polemic. It's a good story that has layers of meaning embedded in it. On which the action adventure, the heroes and the villains ride this wave. And that's what you're looking at, and that's what keeps you engaged, and that's a story you follow. But the only reason they're able to surf this incredible wave that keeps you entertained is because of the depth of the water beneath them and the forces that are making it move.
But tell me a little bit about what your reading tastes were like when you were a child, and did you grow up with a love for speculative fiction, or did that come later? And of course, you moved countries, as you were telling me earlier. Did your change in environment affect your reading and, you know, later on your writing?
Yes to all of that. I mean, I grew up in Jamaica, in the 60s and 70s, and I grew up mostly in a very remote part of the country. There wasn't much access to books or bookshops. There's still actually not a lot of great bookshops in Jamaica now, I'm sorry to say, although there are starting to be a few. So a lot of my reading was what was given to me. It wasn't an option to go to the great bookshop and find the latest stuff. But I'd learned to read very young. These are books that a lot of younger listeners may not even recall. But for some reason, when I was really little, I had stacks and stacks of Bobbsey Twins, Hardy Boys, Nancy Drew.
It's a colonial thing. Nancy Drew, Hardy Boys. Yeah, we all grew up on that. My 7-year-old is now reading Mallory Towers, and I remember reading that.
Right. It's that thing. And of course, when you are that age, you don't know that it's a colonialist
legacy.
Of course
not. You just love it.
You just love it. Those are just books. Because of where I grew up, we were very much on the tourist trail, we were talking about this earlier, very much on the sort of hippie tourist trail that wound up in interesting places in the world. And a lot of what I read as a child and an adolescent were books that traveling tourists had left behind. So I think that's how Dune came into our household. I know that my mother had read and got me, her very precocious early reading daughter, The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. But one of the things I remember is that I had the first two volumes of The Lord of the Rings, and for a long, long time, I didn't get the third volume because it wasn't available in Jamaica and no one was visiting who could be asked to bring a copy. That sounds bizarre. I know it does. But I remember having read The Fellowship of the Ring and The Two Towers 3 or 4 times over before I ever got my hands on The Return of the King. So it was that kind of slightly disjointed reading experience. It's just random stuff. And every now and then someone who was a repeat visitor, who knew my family, who knew this kid, would bring stuff that they thought would be good for me to read or that I would like. I mean, I had a really interesting... I read Uncle Tom's Cabin because that got delivered a very ancient, moldy hardback in the bottom of a box of books that someone had sent because they'd heard there was a kid who liked to read a bunch of random stuff. But in that time, I also read Roots, and I read that mostly in galley form because the author pitched up in our tiny little village to go through the final copy edits.
Really?
And those
really?
Were what I read the Roots manuscript on. And again, when you are reading books like that at 11, 12, 13 years old, your critical faculties haven't really engaged yet. The problems with those books that I became aware of as an adult, with provenance, with white gaze and so on, weren't apparent to me when I was reading them at that age. And speculative fiction was very, very hit and miss. When I went to high school, we had a library there with a lot of books, but I think that they were sort of donated collections. So again, you'd get, someone had obviously collected everything by H.G. Wells and everything by Jules Verne. So I read all of those, but there were other period authors that simply weren't there and therefore I never knew existed. And then when I went away to university in America in my late teens, reading definitely did shift because more was available to me, but I didn't have the time to simply wander randomly and read a lot of stuff anymore. So, you know, a lot of the things one reads in school, Shakespeare and so on, I read again, and the classics, the Brontes, Jane Austen and so on. That was probably when I had the longest break from reading speculative fiction because it wasn't on the curriculum and I didn't have the time. And then I kind of found my way back into certain forms of it later on when I was out of university and my life was my own again.
So now that all your books, all three of these books, all three of your, should I say your first trilogy, now that they're... I don't want to refer to them as your first, your first three books, I guess. I'm sure you have plenty more in you.
I don't know if there'll be another trilogy, but there will definitely be more books.
Well, let's put it this way then. This trilogy, or your first three books, either way, now that they're out there, and of course it is a trilogy, so it is out there as this entire independent entity by itself. Now it's people are interacting with it. It's interacting with people. You know, the idea of reader's baggage comes into it. You can't do anything about it anymore. You know, it's out there. It's gone. No. Do you still like it? Would you want to make any changes now? Do you have regrets or none?
No, that is such an interesting question. I don't have any regrets. And I do still like it, and I am quite proud of it. I don't have a whole lot of distance. I hope somebody asks me that question again in 10 years when
I'll ask you.
I'll
make a note of it, yes.
And, you know, I don't really have any regrets, because when I look at it now, I think they're all good books. I'm proud of all of them. But I also think that my technique has gotten better with each successive book. So every now and then, if I flip through Gem Signs, I will notice a phrase that I wish I could polish up. You know, I think, oh, I could change the tense there or shift that preposition. I don't like repetitions when the same word shows up in successive paragraphs, unless you've done that intentionally, but sometimes things slip through that you hadn't noticed, and I'll notice that now. But I don't regret it, because A, it's still a good book. I mean, it's a book that's on curricula already. So I take that as some sort of a stamp of approval that it's not my imagination. It is a really good book. And B, I think things show their passage and they show your passage. I wouldn't choose to go back to them, because it would almost be like undermining who I was and what I was thinking and what I was capable of at that particular moment in time. Everything I ever allow to be published is at that moment exactly what I think, exactly what I want to say, and absolutely the best that I can possibly make it. And I think if you work really hard and you want to constantly improve, then it follows that you'll be capable of more in 2 or 3 or 5 or 10 years. But you have to go through the process.
Right.
And what you put out along the way marks your passage. Do you know what I mean? So
yeah.
I don't ever want to dishonor that learning process by saying, oh, I wish I could change such and such a thing. And to be quite honest, there isn't anything major that I wish I could change. Every now and then I'll read a sentence that I think I could write that sentence better now, but nothing that makes me terribly upset.
And even that, knowing that you can write something better now, well, that's a good thing. Of course, you should be able to write it better now.
Absolutely. And being able to see that is part of how you know you're getting better.
Yeah. And it doesn't mean it's a bad sentence. It just means you're better.
Exactly. That's the thing. I do have to give my editors a bit of quite a bit of credit here. I do edit myself ruthlessly. So I don't sort of assume that it's any good. I start with the assumption it's probably rubbish and have to convince myself that it's good writing. And I've got one of the best editors in the business, Jo Fletcher, who knows that that is my approach and it's also her approach. And she doesn't let any dodgy sentences make it into print, for which I'm really grateful. You know, I do think we don't always give the editorial process and the talent that requires enough credit in this business, because if they do their job really well, we get all of the praise. But actually, I think anyone who is really interested and committed to the literary value of their work will probably tell you that their editor has a lot to do with the quality of what comes out.
Yeah. Now, what's next for you? You just mentioned there will be other books. Can you tell us a little bit about what's next? Have you started working on one? Because obviously, you know, Regeneration might have been out recently, but you finished it a while ago.
I finished it a while ago. It was really quite a difficult book to get out of me. And it took a lot of editing, this one particularly, but it's been out of me for a while. And I am starting to work on another book, which is quite different. It's quite strange. I seem to have needed a longer break between the end of Regeneration and the beginning of the next thing, just to get, because I'm going to be doing something completely different next. And it was almost as though I needed to give the last lot enough time to move out of my head so something else could move in. And the next, but the next book is pretty much planned now. It's going to have a quite a different structure and quite a different aim. And I'm not even sure which genre of fiction I want to class it in. It'll be speculative. One of the things I was thinking about in Gem Signs in particular, and it's one of the pieces of subtext in that novel, but it's not a particularly strong theme in the Evolution trilogy, was the idea of how myths form, and the idea of how something that sort of becomes part of the mythology, the founding legends of a people begins. There's a way you can actually read Gem Signs in particular as what a creation myth might look like if you were there at the time. I don't know if that makes any sense at all, but it was one of the things in the back of my head as I was writing it. And then it turned into a science fiction novel and a science fiction trilogy, and that notion pretty much went by the wayside. But it's something that I'm really interested in. I have an abiding interest in anthropology and in how narrative and stories take people's idea of themselves forward into the future, and how their history becomes their legends. And so I'm going to be playing around with that quite a bit in the next book, with the idea of how stories become almost codified into sacred texts when they become foundational. That sounds really academic, doesn't it?
No, it sounds really intriguing.
Academic, once I'm done with it, I promise.
No,
it'll be fun.
Maybe I'm just a really big nerd, but I think it sounds really intriguing. I'm most interested.
Oh, good. Well, now I've got to pull it off.
So yeah. You have at least one person waiting impatiently, yes.
Fantastic.
But just speaking a little bit about Jamaica, as you were earlier, being, you know, born there, being sort of living there for so many years, do you ever get, you must at some point be asked, you know, why are you not a quote-unquote Jamaican writer? Why are you not setting your stories in Jamaica? Why isn't Jamaica part of what you write about?
It does. Well, it's assumed quite often that because I'm a Jamaican writer, the stories must be set in Jamaica. They must have that influence. And then people are quite surprised when they're not. And in response to which, I say, well, first of all, that identity and that history does inform who I am, and therefore how, you know, what I write about and how, yeah, I think about it. But this is one of these really interesting, almost insidious burdens that I think is placed, probably unintentionally, on people from developing countries or marginalized communities, the expectation that that ought to be their area of focus. And,
yeah,
and what I tend to say to people is, look, if I were a white bloke from New York or London, would you expect that I would only be writing stories about the mainstream communities in New York and London?
Oh, well, you see, if then, as a white bloke from New York or London, you wrote about Jamaica, they'd say you were just magnificently diverse.
Absolutely.
not to be all sarcastic about it, but that's what they'd say.
That's generally what they'd say. And, yeah, I'm not saying this to be mean to white blokes from New York or London, because there are a great many of them that are brilliant, brilliant,
right,
writers.
Absolutely.
And there is not that sense of constraint. There is not that sense that the entire world and all its possibilities is not their terrain to explore and part of their entitlement. And I'm not actually interested in telling people what they shouldn't write about. I simply claim the same territory. There is absolutely no reason why a mixed race woman from a village in Jamaica can't claim all of time and space as her area for imagination and for literature, in exactly the same way that our hypothetical white blokes from London and New York can. But we're not used to thinking about it that way.
Yeah. Well, the reason,
and that's one of the things I'd like to challenge, because why wouldn't I?
Yeah, why wouldn't you? Well, the reason I bring it up is not because I think you need to do it, but I was interested in knowing how you felt about it. Because, for example, I mean, I don't write fiction, but if I'm a reviewer from Pakistan, I'm often expected to only know about, say, South Asian literature, you know, which makes no sense. Why would I only know about what's around me? Why would I not know about the rest of the world? And so I feel that, you know, it's almost in a way of continuing to other someone, because,
yes,
you're kind of telling them that you're great at this, but you just do what you do, you know, you be you in your part of the world.
it's a weird, it's all often almost couched as a compliment. You know so much about X, why aren't you focusing on that? But it's actually quite exclusionary. So it's a kind of prejudice that disguises itself.
Yep.
By making it seem as though you're so special, you're so exotic, one of my least favorite words.
Yes, oh, exotic.
You should be focusing on the thing you know about, but it is a way of continuing. It's a kind of psychological ongoing colonialization in a way. It's a yeah. way of continuing to try and define what the limits of imagination and interest and influence should be.
Yeah.
And I'm all about challenging orthodoxies. I've been doing it for closing up onto half a century now, and I have no intention of turning back. Yeah. I mean, I think it's an interesting question to be faced with, because it does happen quite often. And one of the I get asked it in Jamaica as well. I get asked it by people there who go, "Well, you're abroad and you've got a 3-book deal, as happened a few years ago when I was there, and the expectation that you're writing the sort of great the great novel of Jamaican diaspora or whatever."
Oh, diaspora, but, my other favorite word alongside exotic.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. The two of them, yeah, they're hand in glove. We could do a little glossary of words that other people find complimentary, but that I find purely tedious.
Yes.
I made that analogy about writers from developed major power countries versus myself. And when I made that analogy about, or poor blokes from New York and London who were abusing terribly. Everybody kind of got it, because they, you know, nobody likes feeling as though they're being put into a box that other people are not put into. But we are so used to those boxes that quite often we don't think of challenging them unless somebody else does it first.
Yeah. And on that note, thank you so much for taking the time out to speak to me today.
It's been a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much.
And hopefully we will speak again when this next intriguing book is out.
When I've got it written and it's out, you will be one of the first to know about.
I will be excited to read it. Thank you, Stephanie.
Thank you, Mahvesh.